And you've just entered the law offices of Quibble, Squabble, and Bicker. If you've come for actual legal advice, you need to turn right around, honey. You need to get out of here, because you ain't going to get none of that. They quibble, and they squabble, and they bicker. But if you want to hear meaningless opinions, this is the right place. They got plenty of that. Stuff that makes no sense at all. They go off on tangents. It's crazy talk. If that's your thing, keep listening. They'll keep talking.
Oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. It's another episode of the Law Offices of Quibble, Squabble, and Bicker. You've entered the Law Offices of Quibble, Squabble, and Bicker.
Yay!
Welcome back to the Law Offices of Quibble, Squabble, and Bicker on this January 6th, 2021. Donald Trump still has not conceded the election. There are riots in the capital of the United States of America, and we're still not really, you know, doing anything about it. So, but this is an incredibly special program for us because we have the legendary character actor Larry Hankin, who you've seen on Breaking Bad, seen with Seinfeld, Friends, etc., especially Escape from Alcatraz, which is kind of his breakthrough role. And today, for some reason, he's lowering himself to our level to have a basic discussion.
Okay.
Yes. So, just to introduce ourselves to you, Larry, I'm Matt. Brendan is in the lower right-hand corner of my screen wearing the math hat. Greg is in the upper left corner of my screen, looking like someone straight out of the Blair Witch Project. And he'll probably be reminiscent of that as the rest of it, the show goes on. But I'll leave it open to you guys. If you can, later on, we'll be talking about our client because Larry is here as guest counsel for our later client that we'll be representing, which is Homo Sapiens, Love It or Leave It. That will be the client for the day. But for now, we're going to talk to our guest counsel, get to know him a little bit better. Greg, do you have anything you want to start off with?
Well, where did you study law, Larry?
I studied law. I think it was like the seventh or eighth grade.
Okay.
And I took a course in law. And I know you can't spit in school. I know that. And there's a lot of things.
You're more qualified than us already.
Yeah, but mainly the only win I have is to stay late. That's the only, if I win, you get to stay late. That's the only law that applies to what I practice.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. That's a universal law.
Yeah.
If you win, you stay late.
Yeah, you know, you're gonna have to stay late.
And you got a tip.
Well, no, and probably you have to write a couple of things on the board 1,000 times. But, you know, we'll talk about that.
Well, Brendan, you would know about that because you're wearing the math hat.
I wrote a lot of things on a lot of chalkboards, true, over my years. That's sort of what brought me into law was I wrote that shit too many times on the chalkboard and went,
this shit.
And that's enough of that. So
speaking of breaking the law, though, there was an interview I saw with you, Larry, where you said that you were an arsonist. You were a firebug as a youth.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah, I was.
So was it you just liked to light things on fire? Was it?
I loved fire.
Was it animals or what did you, were you lighting on
no,
fire?
No, I burned down a barn, a billboard. you know, I was an arsonist, man. I mean,
did you ever get caught?
Fuck around?
Did you have to go to jail ever or you never?
No, I was never caught.
You're good at it. You're a good arsonist.
Well, luckily, there's a statute of limitations.
And the barn was directly, I swear to God, the barn was in a lot directly across the street. I lived in the suburbs, but there was lots around anyway. But it was a suburbs, you know, regular suburbs. And right across the street was a small lot. You know, it had never been used. And there was a barn there, an old, old barn. And I burned that barn down.
So and it was right across the street.
It was a barn fire, yeah. And very good. And I was never caught. And the crime was right across the street. So that was pretty cool.
What suburb was this where the barn was burned down?
Oh, well, now, you know, police records and stuff.
There's a statute of limitations, isn't there?
You want me to turn myself in? No.
No.
70 years later, they're coming after him.
Well, no, when I was like, you know, 15 or 16, you know, 17.
Well, you know, I mean, I was a bit of a bomber. I like to blow things up. I wasn't a firebug, but I did blow up a payphone in my hometown. I think I was about 17.
You mean like in those booths?
Yeah, like the booths. So I
wow. Good for you, man.
This is the 80s.
We gotta talk later.
Yeah,
absolutely. Good work.
I feel a connection. So this was the 80s. So I walk in, I've got a mohawk. I'm buying pipes. I'm buying waterproof fuse. I'm buying, like, I'm asking the guy, what's the most explosive gunpowder you have? And I'm 16. He's just putting this out. I'm buying it. I leave. I blow up a payphone.
That was the 80s. Was someone in the payphone at the time?
No,
Superman.
No. You know, that guy who sold you that stuff.
Right?
Where was he at? I don't know.
Like, there's three punk rock guys. I'm like a mohawk. This guy's got a skinhead, and we're buying obvious explosives. And he's just like, yeah, it'll be $27.95. And I'm like, great.
Yeah, right. Well, he's got to pay the mortgage, you know?
And asking for advice on how to blow things up. Oh, could you give us some advice while we're
Yeah. Well, that's extra. $5. I mean, you know, come on.
Well, Brandon has like kind of a storied history of things blowing up because he was once like in a riot where a police car wound up on fire.
Oh, wow. Well, you see.
Yeah. And Molotov cocktails were thrown. But not necessarily. We don't know if Brendan actually saw the Molotov cocktails being thrown at cop cars.
I escaped prosecution and I'm not going to say anything more about it.
Yeah,
probably a good idea.
I've outgrown it. By the way, I've outgrown it. I have not blown up or set anything on fire since then. But because of my prowess in the arson field, I was the fire tender in Boy Scout camp.
Oh.
So there you go. So
Was that before or after the barn was lit up?
No, that's after. I learned my lesson and I cashed in.
It's like the criminals become
cops. I didn't
have
to go on hikes. I had to stay back and keep the fire going.
Right.
So I didn't have to do all that crap, you know, hiking and all that. No, I stayed behind. Or I built the fire and then I put it out. I tended the fire. It was a great job.
So you're a fire eagle scout.
Yeah, exactly.
That's good.
I did good. I turned it into a plus, is what I.
What a brilliant use of an obsession. That's really fantastic.
Into the Boy Scout,
a criminal obsession.
I never found a way to, like, you know, Jack Parsons my way into blowing things up legally. Yeah, no.
Construction. That would be, you know,
demolitions.
I did some demolition, but it was mostly just jackhammer and sledgehammer. There was no bombs and blowing up. So
you're doing it the hard way.
Right. Yeah.
Jackhammer. Yeah. Give me a fucking fuse. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, after 18 though, you're liable. And I knew that. So I just cooled it. Yeah.
So I have a question regarding your website. So everybody who wants to know, his website is therealLarryHankin.com, and Hankin is H-A-N-K-I-N. And I really like your artwork. And I noticed that you sell onesies as part of the merchandise. And I was curious, like, how big of an infant fan following do you have that the onesies
are? Well, there's two answers. First of all, onesies were for little children. They were the onesies, you know, the one piece little for 2 years old. But then some designer got the idea that men would like this. So they blew them up to men's sizes. So the onesies, I guess I haven't checked because I go through TeePublic. My site for t-shirts is what you're talking about. But you can also get onesies and wallets and kerchiefs and anything with art on it.
Everything seemed kind of normal, but then I saw the onesies.
The onesies are their idea. It's not mine. I just give them my art. And they push it, you know, and they're pushing on a onesie. I haven't even seen the onesies.
So men wear onesies now?
Are these
the kind of men who like wearing diapers?
No, it's not diapers. A onesie is just a one piece. It's like what the mechanics wear in the shop, you know.
Okay, I know what a onesie is, but it just seems like a grown man wearing one might be the kind of diaper guy.
I've seen guys in them. Diapers. They don't look as stupid as it sounds. I've seen guys in them.
Okay.
I want to say I was talking to my 25-year-old daughter about buying a onesie just today.
Oh, yeah. For a girl, it would be great. It would be great.
For me.
For you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, go to my site.
I will go there.
LarryHankin.com. Just tell her to go there.
Yeah, and your artwork, I really like your artwork, so I think it would be good.
We'll take care of you. Don't worry about it.
Fantastic. I need a onesie.
So my wife actually bought 5 sets of, I call it long underwear for all of us, and for the holidays. And
long underwear.
Basically onesies. Yeah, exactly. So
there you go.
The only one who got artwork on theirs was mine, because mine was camouflage for some reason. And I'm not known as like a hunter or anything. I'm like, are you doing this?
Especially
so you don't
in your underwear.
See me anymore. Right. I'm very hard to hide, honestly.
What is the idea of putting camouflage on underwear?
I don't
know. What is that?
It's so you can hang out in Afghanistan.
A bear steals your clothes?
No, it's when you're camping, you can sneak up on your wife.
Oh, okay, cool. All right, yeah. I got it.
She's laying there in the tent, kind of just looking around, and you're sneaking up and on her. Right. You know,
there's nothing here but leaves in this tent with me.
Yeah,
I want to hear about your role play with your wife, Brendan.
yourself. You're in the woods. I'm in the woods. I got my long underwear on.
I'm sneaking up on my wife, pretending I'm a bear.
Don't knock until you try it, Greg. That's all I'm saying.
Got to watch out for the poison ivy, though. All right, I want to get back to Larry. It's all my fault. So, Larry, you also have a connection to Greg in that you were homeless for 1 year of your life.
Yeah, so
I was never homeless.
You just went into dumpsters for fun?
No, to get cheap food, but I had an apartment at the time. But
I didn't know that part. I thought you were homeless. I'm sorry that I made a mistake.
No.
Don't assume.
Yes.
Yes. Do not assume.
In this case, I just made an ass out of myself and no one else.
But Larry, I saw an interview with you where it was amazing how that gave you helped your acting career, because you played homeless characters.
Well, so no. It was research. It was research because I was evicted from my home for not paying the rent. Not that I didn't have the money. I was an employed actor, small salary in San Francisco in an improv company called The Committee. So I could have paid the rent, but I was in another city trying to make some more money for 2 months. And I didn't have the address of the landlord. So I just figured, well, I'll wait until I get back. I'll have a lot more money and I'll even give her a tip, you know, for the time that she didn't have the rent for 2 months. But when I got back, she had already evicted me she didn't know where I was. So I got evicted, and then I started living in my car until I could find another place because, you know, just all of a sudden I'm out in the streets. There was no, like, I get home from 2 months and my apartment is empty. Everything was, I was living on an LSD. You know the landing barges?
We're familiar with LSD
Omaha
here.
Beach? Well, no, not that LSD. The boat.
Oh, okay.
LSDs. The landing barge on D-Day on Omaha Beach. You know, the door goes down and the troops go down.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Where was this?
Well, somebody bought, a junk dealer who was on the shore of San Francisco Bay had a junk yard, and you could bring in stuff from the sea or from the road.
I was thinking a different kind of junk entirely, but go ahead.
No, yeah. So he bought 10 of those landing barges from the war, real from the Omaha Beach stuff.
Huh.
Yeah. After the war, he was a junk dealer, so he figured people want them, he'll buy 10. So he put them out about 50 feet off the his dock. Just 10 of them, very far apart, but they were all anchored in shallow water, about 10 to 20 feet. And each one had a rowboat that he bought from a park somewhere, Central Park or somewhere, old rowboats. So you got a rowboat and you got an it's an LSD, I think, or LSB, whatever. But they were just empty. All they were just somebody tore the front door that goes down like that and made it permanent, caulked it, and then put a door in there. And then
roofs on those? Is there a top on those things?
They roofed it over. They built sideboards about, and it was about 7 feet. It was just about that high above my head. And the sideboards, then they cut holes for windows, put glass in. It was all by local craftsmen.
It's kind of like living in a storage container.
Yeah, Exactly, with windows and a roof with tar paper over it on the top, and then one wire that came in, which is your electricity from the dock, and you rode out, and it was just whitewashed. The inside was swept clean and whitewashed with duck boards, because the bottom of those boards of those boats are like this, you know, because they're boats. So right. They put duck boards across. So you had duck boards empty, and then had a little pallet at the back where the steering guy used to be. But they put a pallet, and then you could put a mattress on it. It was just a wooden pallet.
So not quite a houseboat, but more of an apartment boat.
It was a boat boat. It was an empty boat. It wasn't an apartment. It was nothing. It was just empty. Oh. And I brought in a mattress, and I left for 2 months. I lived there for 6 months, rode in every month, paid her cash. That's why I didn't have the address. I just rode in, paid her cash, rode back.
So that was the thing you got evicted from, was one of these boats.
Was this boat. And then when I came back from 2 months trying to earn money so I could get a real apartment, this was $150 a month in San Francisco. That was really cheap. So by the time I got back, everything that I put in there, my mattress, my clothes, my books, my radio, my records, my everything, it was empty again. She threw it overboard. She just rode out one night and just threw it overboard. Everything.
Whoa.
Yeah, everything.
Oh, Larry, you do not exist anymore.
Did you ever find like little bits of brain in the
corner? I was blown away when I walked in. You know, it's like I was like the day before I moved in. It was just whitewashed. That was
That's cold, especially the records, man. I mean, throw away whatever you want.
Yeah, I had a really good collection of records.
Yeah,
man.
Fuck you, throw away my records.
Oh, exactly.
Burn in hell.
That peed me. It peed me off really, totally bad. And then I lived in my car. And then while I was living in my car looking for an apartment, I did have enough money for a cheap, really cheap apartment. I started digging it, living in my car. I loved it. I stayed there for a year.
Did you like bathe by using like the radiator tube or something? Or
say that again.
How did you bathe in your car?
Oh, you go over to friends' house. I didn't bathe in my car.
Oh, okay.
I went over to, and then that wore thin. That's why I got out. Finally, phone calls, baths, showers, meals are really hard to come by. Plus, towing away your car when you parked in the wrong place for too long. People stealing your guitar because you left your car alone. People stealing just a lot of stuff. Nothing, by the way, here's something. If you're going to be homeless, you do not own anything when you are homeless. You just have it, and then you don't. It's just that simple.
Because someone else will probably take it.
Well, and you have no recourse. And the cops won't help you. You ask around, nobody will tell you where it is. So you either have stuff or you don't have it anymore. And that's it. And if you make that curve in your thinking, you can be homeless. Other than that, so I did do that. They stole a beautiful guitar, man.
So were you in bands back then?
No, I couldn't play.
Oh. So the guitar was just decorative.
Listen, when you're living in a car, you know, after it gets dark, there's nothing for you to do. So I got the guitar and a friend, I had enough money to buy a $150 guitar. Now it's probably worth $2,000. Easy. But then it was $150 and he helped me. And he was an expert musician at buying guitars. And he took me into a store and he picked out a beautiful guitar, which was only $150, and it was a 12 string. It was beautiful. And I just loved, you know, I knew one chord, A, I think maybe I knew E. And I would just plunk it, you know, because passing the time. And there's not much you can do in a car, you know.
Well, you did two chords, so you must have gotten at least one or two songs out of those.
Yeah, but I was kind of also dyslexic, so I couldn't play. I really couldn't. Now I can. I mean, now I've had a guitar all these years.
A and E, you're almost to Iron Man.
The blues.
Oh, yeah, the blues. That's another one.
The Ramones.
I can play the blues. Well, now I can play the hell out of the blues. But then, no, it was just something else to do. I would draw. I would read. I mean, you're on your own when you're homeless, man.
And about how old were you at that time? Early 20s? Or?
Yeah, early 20s. Yeah,
it's kind of a good time in life to, you know, to be able
to. Yes, and that was the other thing. Adventure. I thought, hey, I'm 25 or 23. I don't know what the hell I was. But yeah, I thought, oh, well, I'm going to try this out. Let's see where it goes. Let me see if I can survive. You know, I just wanted to explore it. You know, I was an actor. I was a writer. I was curious. You know, I was dyslexic. I didn't give a fuck.
Right. So sometimes you didn't think it was a car. Right? You thought it was more of a rack or something, as opposed to a car, because of the dyslexia.
No, I had a VW bus. The green one, the classic one, the green and the cream.
So it was a little bigger than a normal car. That's good.
Well, yeah, but it was totally devoid of anything. It looked like a delivery truck. It was only metal. There was no seats. There was no cloth. It was just a metal enclosure with one seat for the driver. If you were riding with me, you sat on a box. Shotgun side.
So it's like a little, almost like a cargo van, but smaller.
Exactly. Like a UPS truck. Only it was a VW van. And I just lived in it.
You know. So it was like your LST boat apartment.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
A box.
I was going to say.
I was in that mode, see, because of the LSD. And then I went into the car, into the VW. So it was, I was used to that. Nothing around but windows and the floor and the ceiling. And
so did you move from there to like
into an apartment
and then I
got
box?
Then I got a girlfriend and then she had a kid and then we got an apartment and then I became a human being, you know.
That's where it all went wrong, Larry.
And that's exactly where the trouble starts.
Yes. That's where it went off the rails.
You were describing the living in the van thing and I was a little like getting a little like
jealous.
Man, that sounds so good.
Yeah, it was. Let me tell you, man, it was cool because I had a little money coming in. I mean, I wasn't bereft. I had enough for food. I could, and I knew where to buy food. I, you know, and then, and I nearly killed myself too because I thought, well, it's cheaper if I cook the food myself. Nobody told me that if you get a little hibachi and you put charcoal briquettes in it and you close all the windows and the doors,
you can
kill yourself by being asphyxiated, Larry. Nobody told me that.
It's a learning experience.
Yeah.
In your youth.
Oh, well, I'll keep this hibachi going while I go to sleep, so I'll be warm tonight.
Larry, as how old were you when you started getting roles? What were your first roles? Were you like in your mid-20s when you started getting some big
As soon as I left college, so that would be like 18 or 19. I guess 19.
What year is that, roughly?
1959, 1960, 61, right in
so
in
what,
there.
So what kind of gigs would you get? Like commercials or weird little walk-ons?
No, what I did was I went to Syracuse University and I graduated as industrial designer. And I was offered a lot of money. Like, I guess it's still a lot of money. I was an A student as industrial designer. And I was hired, they wanted to hire me for General Motors to design future cars at about, I don't know, starting salary of like $50,000 or $75,000 a year. That was like a fucking fortune in the 60s.
Yeah, back then, no kidding.
Of college, are you kidding?
Yeah.
But my best friend was Carl Gottlieb. I don't know if you know who Carl Gottlieb is, but he wrote Jaws.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I know that work.
Yeah. So
and he directed Caveman.
And he directed Caveman, which I was supposed to be in, and I turned down the role. Damn it. He wanted me to be the lead, and I turned it down because I didn't get it.
You were the only one who didn't get it, but that's okay.
Right.
Keep going.
What was the question?
Oh, Carl Gottlieb, sorry.
Oh, yeah, so Carl Gottlieb. So he graduated at the same time I did, and we were best friends through the last 2 years of college. So he said to me, what are you doing after college? And I said, well, I don't know. I guess I might go to, you know, Detroit and design cars. And he said, well, I'm going to Greenwich Village to be a writer. Why don't you come with me and we can get an apartment in Greenwich Village? God knows what's going to happen to you in Detroit. And who your roommate's going to be.
So did you meet Gottlieb in college?
In college, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He was in the writing department. Or I don't know what, literature, English. I don't know what the department.
Okay.
I was in the art school, but the design department, which means I had to take algebra and mechanics and physics and all that.
You had to do math.
I had to do math. He didn't. And so he said, let's go then. I said, but what will I do there? And he said, well, you'll find something. And I said, that's good enough for me. Let's go to the Village. Because I grew up in New York. So the Village was like a mecca to me. And if he was going to share rent, man, screw the Detroit and the money. I'm going there. So I did, and I starved there. So back, so that was in the beginning of my starvation on the boat, in the car. I was living with him, but I was starving, and he would steal food for me.
Oh, wow. Because
I couldn't find a job.
So wait a minute. At what point did Carl sort of like let you drift off to living in the boat in the car?
No. Here's what happened. He didn't let me drift off. What happened was he was drafted. I was living in this house, this apartment, in this cheap 6-floor walk-up apartment. Really, really cheap. I think it was, $200 a month. So it's something ridiculous. I don't know. But anyway, it was really cheap and you had to walk up. Okay. So we were there and I was looking for a job and I didn't want a job. And he was stealing money because he was reviewing films. So he had some money. So what he would do was when you go to review a movie, even back then, and now if it's upscale movies, back before COVID, when you go in and you're a reviewer, what they do is they serve you wine, to loosen you up. There's a little get together in the bar before you go into the movie. They serve you wine and they serve you those cold shrimp, those bowls of cold shrimp, mm-hmm. The raw
shrimp cocktail.
Shrimp. They serve bowls of those. And he was doing this for 3-4 months. And it was always the same thing. And though he was reviewing small movies, little independent things, he was going to where the big movies were being reviewed. I mean, he was just a reviewer like everybody else. So he was going to upscale reviews where they had these shrimp. So what he would do is, and he had to wear a suit. Everybody had to wear a suit in those days, the reviewers.
Of course.
So he would wear a suit. They would have damask napkins. And back in those days, no paper napkins. Real linen napkins. He would take a linen napkin. He would take a handful, big handful of the shrimp, and he would put it in a napkin, wrap it up. He put it in his pocket, and he would take it home for me for dinner.
That sounds very.
That's probably where the idea for Jaws came from. Was just him like handfuls of shrimp into the napkin.
Well,
and there's Jaws.
I don't think so.
I don't think so because
here's the kicker. The kicker is that. He was doing this for 3-4 months, 3 to 4 meals nights a week. Wow. He would bring home these things, put it in. So I was saving the napkins. So the napkins in the apartment were all over the place. I just thought it was very funny that these were my meals that were all over the place. And we would use them for rags and stuff like that. But I would hang them all over. But one day he says, all right, I'm stopping. I'm not going to do this anymore. And I go, why? And he says, because my suit smells of fish and I only have one suit. So
that's
that
what I was thinking.
So that was went by. So that was over. And then he got drafted. So I was now alone in the apartment and I couldn't pay my half of the rent. What I was doing for my half of the rent was I was working open mic nights and I was getting either tips, that we would share, all the open mic night people for that night would share the tips. Or I would open for somebody on, say, a Friday or a Saturday night in the coffee house where I was doing open mic nights, and I would get paid a couple of bucks for that.
So you're doing stand-up comedy back. This was what, 1960s, 61?
Yeah, in the 60s.
Yeah, okay.
So would you see young Bob Dylan and stuff on the stage?
Yeah, he was, he would come in. As a matter of fact, Dylan would always come to my shows. Well, later on, when I became famous and the committee and doing stand-up, he came by when he played Berkeley. He would come by the committee and we would go and have a beer. He would say, hey man, I really think you're funny. And I go, how do you know even me? How do you even, because he asked for me. He said, hey, when can I talk to Larry? And some people came backstage and this Dylan is outside. He wants to talk to you. I go, what the fuck does he want to talk to me about? I don't know him. I mean, I remember he was in the Village. I walked out on him. He was an awful singer and he couldn't play fucking guitar. What does he want me for? But I went out because now I knew he was a genius now. That was back then when we were both in the Village, when he was just starting and I was just starting. So, but now he was famous and he was doing Berkeley and he was, so I go, whoa, wow. So I go out and he goes, hey, Larry, how you doing? And I go, what, how do you even know of me? And he said, I used to come and see you in the Village all the time, Cafe Agogo and stuff like that. whoa, man, I went to see you once. And I thought, I didn't want to bring up the Village because I was going to thought he was going to ask me, why did you walk out on me?
Right.
I really thought he was going to, and I had no answer because I thought you were bad, man.
I had to get my shrimp napkin.
I had to really go.
I had an appointment. I had a gig.
I had diarrhea.
Anything. But yeah, so he came by and then he would recommend me for stuff for years. It was just really cool, man.
So do you still connect with him after all these years at all? Or
no, kind of drifted? Because although he liked me and I liked him, I mean, as a friend, the people he was setting me up with, like the band, you know, and Robbie Robertson and stuff like that, wanted me to do things because they didn't know who I was. It was just like, hey, man, you know, this guy's really funny. You know, he should write a screenplay for you. That's what he told Robbie.
Hmm.
So Robbie called me up. I said, how did you get my number? He said, well, you know, Dylan gave it to me. Oh, okay. What do you want? He said, I want you to write a movie for me. He said, you'd be good writing a movie for me.
Robbie Robertson.
That's outside of your musical bailiwick, Brendan.
Outside of my talent, but I just said yes because they were famous. I had no idea what the fuck a screenplay looked like. I really didn't. I had no idea. I had to buy a screenplay or get a screenplay to see how you do it. But I couldn't. I couldn't because screenplays take a year to write. I mean, that's a serious. It's like writing a book, man.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't cut it. They invited me up to Bearsville
Woodstock.
Woodstock. And I rented a house. They paid me thousands of dollars.
Nice.
And I rented a house.
It's better than shrimp and a napkin.
I wrote, what I did was, the only thing I could do, because, you know, they kept on calling me, Robbie, hey, is it ready yet? Did you write it yet? And they even hired another writer to come. What's his name? He wrote The Magic Christian with, what's his name? I don't know.
He's a big guy. Oh, God, I wish I could.
Terry Southern. Right. So his writing partner, I got Terry Southern's writing partner. He wrote The Magic Christian with Terry. So he came to write with me and he gave me a lot of ideas. So I thought, well, these guys are musicians. I'll just write a poem like Ballad of Reading Jail by Oscar Wilde. I'll do that. That's good enough. That's the only thing I could come up with. So I wrote this Ballad of Woodstock for Robbie.
The Ballad of Woodstock. I want to see that movie.
Well, it's been thrown away. It's lost.
Oh.
But anyway,
maybe you can write a screenplay about watching Woody Allen barf.
No,
I want to see the movie about Carl Gottlieb before the draft bringing the shrimp in the boxcar.
I mean, all those things would be great in a script, in a screenplay. But to write a screenplay, I've just finished two. I told you about the COVID thing. I was writing screenplays, so I wrote two. They're finished. They're out there. They may or may not be made in the next year. I mean, they're real screenplays and they're going to be optioned. Okay. So I know how to write a screenplay now. Then I had no freaking idea what it was, but I will tell you that I will think twice before ever writing a real screenplay again, because it's very difficult. It's time consuming.
Yes.
And you just have to sit there and, you know,
make sure everything works and like all the pieces fit together.
And then you have to show it to different people who have money, but every person has a different idea of what they want the screenplay for you to rewrite it as.
Basically, they want to put
constantly
different
rewriting for people who say they have money. Yeah.
They're putting extra arms on your baby.
So you learn quickly to not listen to people about it because they don't come up with the money. They just want to see their idea written by the guy who wrote the screenplay. And so I stopped doing that.
And the reason I brought up Woody Allen barfing is that I heard you say somewhere that you would see Woody Allen barf, or you knew him as the guy who
barfed. I used to open for him.
Okay.
So he would throw up before going on stage. And I thought that was really funny.
Just like a nerd. Like a nervous thing?
And, yeah, nervous. He would have to go into the bathroom and you could hear then it would go on and it would be really funny. I didn't think he was that funny, but the crowds just loved him. And then, well, I would go on first, you know, I would open. And then they loved me too, but I would stand in the back and watch him. And they would break up at him too, but it wasn't my humor. I would tell stories. Uh-huh. He would tell jokes.
Did you ever hang out with Lenny Bruce in those days?
Yeah, Lenny Bruce. Yeah, he would come by the committee and we would hang out together. That was really cool. We would walk around. He doesn't like to hang out. What he would do is he'd come by and he would watch our rehearsals because he would play Something West, some very big nightclub in San Francisco, which was about 5 blocks away from the committee.
Like Fillmore West.
So in the afternoon, after his mics, the sound check for his show, he would come over to the committee and he would just sit and watch us rehearse. And then one day he came late, so everybody had left, but I was there. So he came in, he said, "Where'd everybody go?" And I said, "Well, we're going to come back for the show. We finished rehearsing." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Come on, let's walk around." So we just walked around and talked and walked and talked. And this, the amazing thing about Lenny is that he was just a guy, man. He's just like Brendan or Matt your name is Pet Fix. What is that?
Pet is my last name. My name's Greg, though. You can call me Greg.
Oh, Greg. Okay. Well, Pet
Lenny
Fix.
Bruce was way funnier.
Oh, Greg. Oh, Greg. It was just like talking to you guys. It just, nothing fancy, nothing heavy, nothing, hey, look at that. Oh, wow, man. Or did you see that thing that, or what movie? And, it's just hanging. And then he, about, about two weeks later, he fell out of the hotel. Remember that? I don't know if you remember that. He fell out of the hotel window. He was so high.
No.
And luckily he was on the second floor. So he just broke something.
Yeah, I'm curious about your stand-up days. So it sounds like you had a pretty good stand-up career going at the time.
Oh, man. I was, I performed for President Kennedy.
So what would you say would be your best bit, the best killer bit that you did, that you could sum up really quick for us, something that that we might laugh at?
I don't tell jokes. I tell stories.
Stories, right.
So my hunks were story like bits. They were funny stories, but I can't, if I just told you the story, it wouldn't be funny.
So you were more of of a storyteller, like a humorist, as opposed to a stand-up comic.
Yeah, I've defined myself as a stand-up, a stand-up social anthropologist. That's what I am.
Okay.
To address Larry's point, being mostly just a consumer of comedy and being on this show and trying to be funny, there was a time where people told jokes, Rodney Definitely. Dangerfield,
right,
Milton Berle, they told right. fucking jokes, but it really changed. Comedy changed when people started telling stories, because right. all the comedians we appreciate and love today, the modern heroes like Patton Oswalt or Louis C.K.
Bill Burr.
Oh, I love Bill Burr.
Yeah.
He's the man.
They all tell stories. They don't
That's
tell
what
jokes.
I did.
Chris Rock tells stories.
That's
he
what I
tell
did.
Jokes. No, Larry, I just want to give you props, because I was just literally talking to my daughter, because I'm kind of a student, I love comedy, and she had no idea who Lenny Bruce was. She wow. had no idea who George Carlin was.
Wow.
So I was like, "You don't know George Carlin?" And she's like, "No." I said, "He is the king of everything." And so we spent about,
George and I, were all those guys were friends of mine. We would meet each other in the nightclubs I played the Playboy clubs and see, meet a
awesome.
Lot of those guys. Tommy Smothers, the Smothers brothers, all
right.
of them, just all of them. But here's the thing, as far as you being a student of comedy, because I am a student of comedy, and what I noticed is you've gone back to the jokes. And that's true. You've got a good picture. There was jokes and then there's stories. But if you go back before the jokes, there were stories. Myron Cohen, the king of storytelling. All those Jewish comedians. Red Fox told jokes and stories. Bell Barth told jokes and stories. But even before then, they would talk about mama and papa. They would talk about their home, the kids. But it wasn't revelatory, critical thinking stories. It was just real family stories that you tell around the dinner table. And then the jokes started, and then the critical thinking, George Carlin, Richie Pryor, all those people, Lenny Bruce started that again.
Right.
But
right.
Only they were getting deeper and deeper. And now you have to go really deep. You have to get naked and curse. And then, you know, bam, you're a hit.
Right. Leonard, do you still do stand-up?
I'm going to go back to it as soon as this COVID thing is over. All stages are closed. You can't do it.
Well, I mean,
I got new shit, man.
You've been doing it all through the years. In between your acting gigs, you've been
I've been doing one-man shows, which are a little different because then I had a point. And now, if you notice, like Brendan, if you notice, go on HBO and you watch Stand Up Now, if you watch the entire hour, you will notice there's a closer. There's an opener and there's a closer, and they tell a kind of a story. It's really not a story. They're just telling their hunks, but they make it into an arc.
Right.
You know, and then at the end, their last story theoretically hooks up with something they said in the first 10 minutes. And it's a story. It's not really a story, but that's what they're doing. They're getting story.
Right. They're connecting those two things.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say, if you want to do a HBO special, you have to have that in mind. Or you can do your stand up, whatever you want. Doesn't matter. Just have the last story hook up with the first story and you got an HBO special. You don't have those two hooks, forget it.
Nah, it makes sense.
On a different tack, 9 years ago, you were given a Lifetime Achievement Award from the LA Music Festival or something like that, a music awards show. And I was wondering, how come you got a Lifetime Achievement Award from a music awards show for being a character actor? Was that ever like explained to you at the time when they gave it to you?
I don't know what you're referring to.
I came across this brief interview where you were given this Lifetime Achievement Award.
Because I did get a Lifetime Achievement Award. I know about it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it came from, maybe I forgot, but I got a Lifetime Achievement Award, but I don't think it came from music because I don't deserve one for music. I didn't.
Right, was the thing that didn't make sense because it was called the Hollywood Fame Award, but it was part of the LA music group of some kind.
I was just wondering
how they connect. Well, you know what? That's an easy thing to do to walk away from this particular conversation.
I heard him in his car playing his 12-string guitar, and they were like, "Damn, he's good."
This is the guitar someone stole from his van. I don't know if these guys have heard your story about John Huston, though, because I had heard that somewhere else, and it was a fascinating story to me of like when you met him for the role of Dog Catcher on Annie, you seemed. Like, I mean, John Huston is kind of like one of my personal heroes too, in terms of in the film industry.
My hero. You know. Well, you want to hear that story?
I think they would. I think Brendan and Greg and our listeners would really love to hear it. Those who are fans of John Huston.
He's a great Homo sapien, if you want to. What happened was. Because I never have gotten into the rhythm of auditions. I hate auditions. I don't like them. And they're all different. It's not like I hate one kind. It's just the whole idea of it. Because I got a call from my manager. This is why. I got a call from my manager. And he said, get down to Warner Brothers right away. What are you doing now? I said, I'm doing nothing, you know. Because you're in between jobs for weeks at a time, sometimes months at a time. You get another life. What are you doing right now? Nothing. Okay, get down to Warner Brothers right away because just get down there. Clint Eastwood is, no, wait a minute, what was it? The casting moved for Annie. And it's a John Huston is directing. Get down there right away. Now, I know that if they say get down there right away, it means somebody got fired. So my attitude immediately is, what do you mean they got fired? They want me to replace somebody? You didn't hire me in the first place? You want me to replace somebody because you didn't hire me? Fuck you. That's my attitude. So I'm going down there with that in mind, with that chip on my shoulder. And so I get down there, and now it's a big thing because it's Annie, it's John Huston. The casting director is a woman. She's Miriam Haggerty or somebody. She's big time. So I'm, and I'm nobody really. I mean, I'm the dog catcher. Yeah. So I get down there, and the first thing, they're waiting for me. So I go in, and she takes me in. She leads me by the arm. She leads me in, and there's John Huston, and he's sitting watching his rushes. And he hears us coming, he turns on his director's chair, and she gets behind me and she puts her hand on my shoulders and she guides me in front of him. And he goes, what are you doing? And she says, I'm putting him in front of you so you can get a good look at him. And he says, don't touch my actors. That's really cool. That is so cool. Nobody's ever said that. He's sticking up for me.
He's kind of an imposing presence too.
Well, he wasn't being imposing. He was just all of a sudden he became this, he's his God. He's his God. I'm being pushed in front of him. It's John Huston. Oh, what is he going to do? What are you doing? I'm pushing him in front of him. Don't touch my actors. All of a sudden he's made me human. He's human. And she's out of here. He's like, so she backs away and he talks to me. He says, you know what the part is, Larry? And I go, yeah, it's a dog catcher. He says, you probably have to cut your hair because I was a hippie. My hair was down to here. He says, you're probably going to have to. Well, I know you're going to have to cut your hair. Is that okay with you? And I go, yeah. And she gets behind me and she takes my hair and she pulls it up, like a ponytail. So getting it away, she says, what are you doing?
Don't touch my actors.
Yeah. She says, I'm getting his hair away from his face so you can see what he looked like with a haircut. And he says, I'm a director. I have imagination. Please do not touch my actor.
That's wow. Really cool that he would embrace you so soon.
I'm thinking, wow, this is amazing. You generally is there just shoving me around and saying, stand over there. You want to sit or dance? So then after she backs away, now she's totally, she's holding her own arms like this. And he says, so Larry, the haircut okay? I say, yes, fine, whatever. He says, okay, fine. Thank you very much.
She never worked again after this because of you. You got fired, but, probably.
No.
Just amputated the wrists.
So she's about to, put her hands on me again to lead me away. And I just see her go, I don't know.
Right. I learned my lesson. Out.
Okay. So then, man, if I had an audience of you guys, I don't know how I'd get through it. That's the difficulty of telling comedy to comedians. They got toppers all the time.
If only we were comedians.
Yeah, but. But anyway, so now here's my habit. This is probably the part of the story you wanted to hear. Is I have a habit of, I know two things. One is when your costume is everything. That's all they give you. Your costume and your lines. When I come in, I ask the AD, where's my costume? Not where's my dressing room or anything else. I say, where's my costume? If he says it's in your dressing room, it's over. You just put it on and do your stuff. If they say it's not in your dressing room yet, you have a shot at choosing your own costume. So I know this. So I go to the costume place. And I'm looking through my costume. I said, where's the costume for the dog catcher? And she says, it's over there. I go in, it's a rack. And all the costumes that could be chosen are a label, dog catcher, dog catcher, dog catcher, dog catcher, dog catcher. And I'm going through them, you know, I'm looking at them, seeing what I, and all of a sudden there's this guy right next to me and he says, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm the dog catcher. I'm looking through my costume. It's okay. I got permission. And he says, you don't have permission. Get out of here. You're not supposed to be here. And I say, no, I'm choosing my costume. I can at least say what I want. You don't have to do it, but I can say whatever. And he says, I have your costume right here. And what he has is what it looks like is a 2-inch thick piece of cardboard, like a box that was flattened down, 15 inches flattened down. And he says, this is your costume, put it on. And I say, and so what I do is I look at it and it's starched, it's folded, it's washed and it's starched. And it's what a garage mechanic would wear. Only it's tan for a dog catcher. But it's a onesie.
It's a onesie.
So I say,
back to onesies.
Yeah, back to onesie. So I peel it off, you know, because it's starched. And I put my hand in it, like my father used to get, you know, his white shirt starched when I was a kid, you know. So I say, I'm not going to put it on. And he goes, why? And I say, because it's starched and it's washed and I'm a dog catcher and it should be dirty because it's 1930 and it's downtown New York and I'm carrying around dogs all day. He goes, you're putting this on. I say, no, I'm not putting it on. He says, if you don't put it on, we're going to John Houston. I said, let's go, because I think he's on my side. He's on my side.
So you're taking a chance that Houston would work with you. That's good.
Yeah. So I said, all right, let's go. So he says, all right, we're going. So he's carrying this like a platter of a crown, like there's a crown on a cushion. I don't know what. He's carrying it like this. It's
costume.
Flat. So we go outside and it has rained the night before. It's a sunny day, but there's puddles around, but it's dry in some places and it's a sunny day, but last night it rained. And there's John Houston again, the same thing. He's looking at his rushes and he turns to us and he susses it out immediately. And he says, okay, what's the problem, George. And he says, this actor, he's really angry. This actor will not put on his costume. Do you have his costume? Yes, here it is right here. Larry, is that true? Yes, it is. Why won't you put on your costume, Larry? Because it's starched and it's clean and it's pressed and it's not dirty and I'm a dog catcher and it's 1930s. Oh, I'm not gonna put that on. He said, is that what he told you? George says, yes. Give me the costume. So George hands him the costume. John Hughes gets up out of his chair, out of his director's chair, and he walks over to the nearest big puddle that he can find. And he's got on Italian shoes, really expensive. That's what I noticed. He's got on Italian expensive shoes. And he walks into the middle of the puddle with his shoes on and he drops, and he takes the costume apart. And he drops it into the puddle and then he walks on it with his Italian shoes and he walks on it in this puzzle. And then he picks it up at arm's length and it's dripping wet. And he walks back to us both. He sits in his chair and he hands it to George. And he says, George, dry this out and put it on this actor. Thank you, George. Thank you, Larry. And he turns back to his...
Back to business.
Glad he wanted it to dry out first. That would have been
wow.
Maybe if he was like, put this wet, disgusting costume on with mud on it.
What would you have done if he had said, no, you have to wear it the way the costume
is? I said, no.
So you would have gone like nose to nose to John Houston.
Hey, listen, man. Don't give me a shit.
Hey, man.
I do what I do.
That's outstanding.
I don't care if it's John Houston. He was on my side. I'm gold. No, I have no qualms about speaking my mind.
That is great because I think that's an excellent segue for us to now tackle our client for today, since you are guest counsel, and the client for today is Homo sapiens, love it or leave it. And I think we should basically start with, you know, what exactly is Homo sapiens other than the only surviving species of the genus Homo? Because modern humans were called anatomically modern humans, but Homo sapiens is different from that?
Homo means man, and sapiens means knowledge. It means thinking man.
Yeah, the scientific term in Latin. I'm not really good with Latin.
No, that's what it means. I mean, that's why they named us Homo sapiens as opposed to Cro-Magnon. It's Homo sapien is thinking erect. Period.
That's Greg's usual thinking.
Thinking erect.
I think erect a lot. I don't think as well erect, just.
Oh, okay. But... Homo supine.
Homo supine. Larry,
no, supine sapiens.
Larry, could you explain to us the difference between Homo sapiens and human beings? You sent us
there is none.
Interesting text.
There is none. We are Homo sapiens.
Yeah. But you seem to not like the term human beings.
Oh, because, yeah. I prefer, because as using the term human beings gives us permission to think we're not a species. But I insist we're a species, so I will call us our species name, Homo sapiens.
So why is it that using the term human beings would make us not a species? Is it just because it's not the species name?
We think we're better than rats and cockroaches and lions and tigers and elephants and pussy.
So when you see a dog, do you say canine? Hey, here's a canine.
No, because they don't think they're anything but a canine. They think they're dogs. They think what they are. We don't think what we are. We think we're something superior because we can think and make things and manifest things. So we think we're superior and we're bullshit. My idea of Homo sapiens is if we keep thinking the way Homo sapiens are thinking now, we are going to be extinct in a couple of thousand years.
I think 100 or 2. Maybe
okay,
50
I'll go
years.
Along with that.
Are you well versed in Latin, Larry? Are you like
no, a, not at all.
Okay, because I was thinking, you know, we could change the word sapiens if that means wise or learned, you know, to unwise or unlearned.
I think that it's an excuse. It's like a weasel word. Oh, human beings has now become a weasel word. You know what a weasel word is? Something to get around something. And human beings are trying to get around the fact there is a possibility that we can become extinct. I'm not saying that we're gonna become extinct, but I'm saying that it looks like there's a possibility and more of a probability that we're gonna be extinct because we keep calling ourselves human beings and not thinking that we're a species that can become extinct.
So I think I'm getting it. So I think there's this differentiation between as the term human being isn't the species. Homo sapiens is the species. Species get extinct, but human beings won't get extinct.
No.
Is that basically what you're saying?
No.
We are
Homo sapiens and we are human beings. Homo sapiens and human beings are the same terms for the same biological animal. Us, the four of us, we're either human beings or Homo sapiens. I'm saying that using human beings as a name is a weasel word for not thinking we're a species. That's all the only difference. I'm not saying it's different. I'm saying stop using a weasel word. It's like saying, hey, you effing people. Effing is a euphemism for fucking. Human beings is a euphemism for Homo sapiens. It's just a nicer way of saying it.
I think part of the human being flaw is that we think we're above nature. We're the only species.
That's exactly why
we don't have to worry about Homo sapiens. Nature.
Right, exactly. Right. I think I understand our guest counsel Larry's point on this point, which is that human beings is a way to get out of the narrative of the fact that we're just an evolved primate. And because we want to say we're more than evolved primate, then we have special powers over the land and the air and the other animals and everything else. And that's really the problem.
Dumb.
Exactly.
It's really dumb. That's what
dumb
it is.
Dumb and the problem. Exactly. Yeah. There you go.
So how do we rectify the use of technology then? Because there's too many.
No, I don't want to change anything except our attitude towards ourselves. It's inside here. I'm not complaining about anything out there. I'm thinking you got to change your mind, people, because there's no other animal on this earth that's poisoning the water. There's no other animal that's putting mercury in the water. Homo sapiens are doing it. No, what, human beings are just another animal, or we're just here. We're not doing anything bad. We're poisoning the water. We're using up the land. We don't have enough food for the people that we do have here. We're just reckless. I mean, at least bats live where they shit. We don't have that ability to live.
We're like a virus, like the Matrix said. We're like a virus.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we're going to keep on being human beings, then learn to fly, hang by our feet, and shit on the floor.
I think most of us actually are pretty good at that last one. But yeah, it's the cleaning up is the more difficult.
So I mean, we're not doing things that other species have done and survived.
I think I want to get into your head more, because there's something within me that's like, there's something that's not clicking in terms of getting the concept that you really want everybody else to get. I think it seemed Brendan and Greg seem to have it, but I think I'm just lost somewhere. So what is the attitude that you want the basic person to have? The basic Homo sapien, what is this attitude that you want them to embrace or embody?
Pay attention to your garbage, whether it's your shit or it's your, milk boxes, your milk
recyclables.
Like have conversations with them?
Recyclables. I mean, stop it, man.
We're in Portland.
Well, you know, the human beings, I'll use your term, human beings, Homo sapiens, are ruining this planet. This is the only planet we have. This is the only Earth we have. This is the only home we have. We live off this planet. Yeah, I'll give you the example. Maybe this will clear it up for you, Matt. Okay, think about an apple, a nice shiny red apple, you know, one that you would bring the teacher. Nice shiny apple in the middle of space. And it's out there in the middle of space. Now, okay, that's one apple. The same apple now on Earth is dropped from a tree, but it's the same apple. And this apple now has fallen on the ground. And this apple, this red shiny apple, is on the ground, and it's now just laying there. A couple of days go by, it rains, gets cold. It's starting to rot, it gets soft. The red starts to get darker and darker. And then all of a sudden, this fur, this fungus starts to grow on the apple, and it starts to grow. And then you go back about a month later, and you see there's all that's left of this apple is a black hard core, and the fuzz, the gray fuzz, is gone. Okay, now you go back to the space apple. Think of human beings, and this is what I think of human beings as Homo sapiens, as apples, that gray fuzz.
Oh.
No, as that fungus, that great fungus. Why did that fungus disappear? Because it ate the apple. That which nourished it is keeping it alive. And when your food is gone, so is your earth.
So you're saying earth is the apple.
Well, I'm saying that we're eating the apple. We're taking too big a bite of minerals and food and waste. And we're dumping it in the water that we drink. So as the fungus on the apple ate everything that was nourishing on the apple to its own demise, it was basically eating itself into suicide.
Got it. So this is like the stages of Ragnarok, where the serpent is eating its own tail.
Exactly. Only the tail is the earth. We live off the earth and we're ruining it.
Right. So we're in like a long-term extended apocalypse.
Well, you know what, Matt, we've talked about this.
And time release apocalypse.
Yeah.
Like a capsule.
Anyway, yeah.
Go ahead, Brendan. Sorry.
I was going to say, we've talked about this and you know, this is a pretty radical approach. And I don't know if Larry is going to, you know, stick with me on this. But, you know, the fact of the matter is any closed system, if there's too many of something, rats.
There you go. No, whatever, I'm with you.
Eventually that shit collapses. It's a biological fact. And so while I am compassionate and I feel for people and everything relative to the pandemic, it is nothing more than a scientific fact that there's too many people and this stuff is going to happen, and it's just going to continue to happen
until
there's less people. And that's a horrible thing to say, and I'm sorry to say it, but it's the truth.
You're saying that Mother Earth is it created COVID to thin the herd to protect itself.
Well, in a way, that's could true, be. But I'd like to take up a point with Brendan. Yes, yeah, but I guess is my point. I think that, yes, right now there is too many people and all systems collapse. But I think because we are sapiens, knowers, we know things, we can think, that's one way we could go. We could go another way, and that is by animal husbandry, you know.
Marrying animals?
Well, no. It's just taking care to have the right amount of children, which may be hard, so I got another way. And that is by taking care to grow enough food and feed enough. In other words, be fair and judicious and understand the damage we're doing and fixing it or modifying it, modification of habit, modification of living style, modification of usage. In other words, tailor our behavior to the amount of given comestibles that we have available and technical ore that we have and blah, blah, blah. You know,
I think the true tragedy of Homo sapiens is that we are thinking we're smart enough to make the technology to ruin the planet, but don't have the wisdom.
Exactly. Here's what somebody told me.
We're going to all die. Like, we're smart enough. We're like smart monkeys. We're smart enough to ruin shit.
Exactly.
But not smart enough to not.
Exactly.
Ruin shit.
A scientist once told me exactly what you're saying, even shorter, but you're right. She said that our curiosity has outgrown our intelligence.
Definitely.
That's the problem.
Or our greed has. I think a lot of it's our greed has. It's like a lot of people just don't want to stop. They just want to have two cars
because
and drive them around all the time.
Well, our greed outpaced our intelligence. Our curiosity. A lot of little things have outgrown our intelligence to control it, like the atomic bomb.
We're smart enough to build things that we can't control, and
we're doing things that we can't control, and we should learn to control things we do.
I think Greg is actually a living embodiment of the philosophy that you're espousing, because he doesn't have a lot of waste except for alcohol bottles.
And I recycle them.
He's never had children. He's never got married, never had children. You know,
good for him. I am not against anything that human beings do that's proactive. I'm not against human beings. I'm not against Homo sapiens. I'm just saying modification and think. If you're a thinking being, think. I don't see people thinking. I don't.
Right. And Larry, that's the part of this conversation where I want to be hopeful that what you're saying is true. I'm just become so cynical, and I'm not even as old as you, at human beings' ability to be better Homo sapiens.
Well, okay. You live in Florida, Brendan.
Okay. No, I'm with you. No, Brendan, I'm with you. I'm expressing it in a positive way, but I kind of believe what you believe, that we're not going to make it.
Well, if we haven't seen like how people have responded to the virus, I think 50% of us are lost cause.
I mean, you know, and then there's Trump, which I mean is a curse to the species. I mean, he is like anti-species.
I think that I just threw something on Facebook earlier today where I felt that he's been a fifth columnist for the Democrats from the beginning. He was put in place specifically to destroy the Republican Party.
Well, he was put in place to destroy the Democratic Party, but it backfired on him. It blew up in his face. But yeah.
Maybe Mother Nature put Trump here to thin the herd. Maybe Mother Nature was like, hey,
yeah. He'll kill a lot. See, now people. That I'll go along with.
He is the bugaboo, the bugbear, the thing that will be the boogeyman.
I mean, those people,
generations to come.
You know, the people who are occupying the White House now, they're not doing Homo sapiens any favors, believe me.
No, no, they're not. and what I think the race of this whole argument is can human beings / Homo sapiens get control of the thoughts in their noggin and put the crazy shit and the animal, the squirrel cage shit in the background and be present and move forward. And I really have this debate with my wife all the time because she's way more the optimist than me. I hope that that's the case. I want that to be the case.
But you don't believe it.
I don't believe it.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
There's this interesting science fiction concept some science fiction authors talk about where, you know, a lot of people say, obviously, statistically, there's other life on other planets just by how many planets there are. And the reason why we'll never see them is because by the time they get advanced enough to reach out to us, they've already blown themselves up. There's something about being sentient, which part of being
there
sentient,
you go.
Petty is being closed, you know, egotistical. Yeah. There's a lot of negative things that come with sentience. And they've already, close to it. We're not going to go to other planets. We might not even make it another century.
Because I saw a little interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson where he was talking about we shouldn't really be focusing on moving to other planets, he goes, because, or terraforming them, he goes, because it would be so incredibly expensive and use so many resources. He said, what we should do is use whatever resources we would be earmarking for that venture to put it back into our current planet
and
make it better.
Exactly.
There you go.
Totally.
Right.
Which is a different concept, and nobody's really looking at that. Like
Neil agrees with me.
And he should.
And he's as smart as Neil deGrasse Tyson, or whoever you say his name.
Well, I may be smarter. So far, we agree on two things. I don't know what else he thinks about. I've watched him. He's pretty cool. Kind of boring, but pretty cool.
Is he related to Mike Tyson?
He's slugging other scientists and astrophysicists every
day. Mike is pretty cool. I think Mike is okay, you know?
Well, he started the Tyson chicken concern.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, they're actually the heirs to the Tyson chicken fortune.
Yeah. They're brothers.
Right.
And Purdue, unfortunately, is the guy who was running.
There is one glimmer of hope that I can give myself, at least. And that is the younger generation, and I'm saying 15 and under, are looking a lot smarter than anybody I know who's older than 15.
You know, Larry, I work with a lot of youngsters. I work at a fast food restaurant. I'm 53, but I still flip burgers. And so I work with lots of 21-year-olds, 18-year-olds. They don't give a shit about recycling. They laugh at me when I say, hey, that's cardboard. Put it in the recycling. They're just like, oh, whatever, old hippie.
No, they're not 15. They're not 15. I'm saying 15 or younger.
Okay. 15,
Larry, I want to give you some credit because that's some wise words. I've got four kids. I've got a 26-year-old, a 23-year-old, a 20-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And my 11-year-old is the wisest of them all, and her older siblings recognize that.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, he's also trained his 11-year-old in like Nietzsche and Descartes and
whatever, man.
The various different other philosophers. So that's a good start.
I know under 15-year-olds who don't know who the fuck Descartes is. Oh, Nietzsche.
I know people our age don't know.
One of the few homeschooling dads who's not teaching their kids creationism and that the earth is 6,000 years old.
I mean,
he's a good
religion is
dad.
Just, I don't know. I can't figure that out.
Don't get me started on religion.
Yeah, don't get me started. Okay, cool. Sorry I even mentioned it. Right.
Best to dodge those topics in some cases. But I think that when we look at Homo sapiens, love it or leave it, I think it comes down to a person recognizing whether they are a Homo sapien or not, like you were saying.
That's
you know, the differentiation between human beings and Homo sapiens. I think some people don't even recognize that they are a thinking being at all.
Exactly.
You know, they're just going along the motions.
Yeah, we're just men and women, you know, just carrying on, you know. And also, other Homo sapiens are lesser than other Homo sapiens.
Yes, that is correct.
You know, like foreigners, people of different colors, people of different heights, people of different diseases.
People who flip burgers at 53.
Yeah, I mean, it's just how they, you know, declinate, I guess is the word. I don't know. Yeah. Differentiate between and subcategories and categorize people. It's just insane.
I'm willing to go on record to say that. I'm willing to go on record to say that you're a better person than us, though. So I can actually make that delineation because you've accomplished so much in your life. And I've done so much and that you've had like a very admirable effect, I think, in general.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Okay. If I've left an effect.
Yeah.
That's cool. That would be my desire, but I'm alive now and I'm just, you know, doing my thing. That's
so
I'm
at this
doing.
Stage, what do you consider your thing to be?
I'm a storyteller, you know, okay. And I hope that within the stories, there is some critical thinking and some help or some knowledge that somebody's missing. But as far as the whole question of art and goes, you know, we're like the antenna of the species, artists. And we're just saying, and each one of us has a little, it's like putting together a puzzle. And I'm one piece. I'm this piece.
That's a good piece.
I'm that piece.
You're not one of the ones on the edge.
Okay.
I am a piece,
and I would like to leave that piece for somebody else to put in later on down the line, you know. But so to leave something behind, but that's all. I mean, while I'm here, I'm kind of nothing. I'm just doing my thing. I'm one human being, one Homo sapien.
Do you have
but
any
after
regrets?
I go, hopefully what I leave will help the others get along. People
do you have any regrets
15.
As a Homo sapien, something that you feel that you should have changed maybe along the way?
Yeah, I listened to my father. That's my one regret, that I listened to my dad. He was not a cool guy.
What did he tell you that you followed?
Nothing, absolutely nothing. I learned nothing from my dad.
But what was it? You said you listened to him. There was something of his that you listened to that you regretted listening to. What was
that?
Yeah,
go
thing?
To sleep at 9. Don't color outside the lines. Shut up. Be quiet. Don't think. Don't be curious.
I had a dad like that.
Follow me. You know, all that bullshit. And I listened and I did everything. You know, my first 15 years were just quiet rebellion inside my head and my room. And I would sneak out at night, my window, and climb down the garage and after midnight, after they
lighten barns on fire.
And light bombs on fire and stuff.
Good for you.
I used to do things that he didn't know about, you know, but every once in a while, cause he was my father. I mean, and he would, I would get beatings, you know, I hate to say that, but I did, you know, he just wasn't a cool guy. I mean, I thank him. I do thank him for getting me here. I mean, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here. So I got to give him props.
The very least he could do.
That's the very least he could do. He got me here and he kept me fed, you know, when I needed to be fed and you know, until I was about 16. Or 17.
And he bought you medicine sometimes when you were six.
And he got me doctors and stuff. He kept me alive. Yeah. He got me here and he kept me alive, kept me healthy. That's pretty cool. That's a heavy duty thing.
So was he a Homo sapiens or was he a human being?
He was a human being.
Okay.
He had no idea he was a Homo sapien.
Do you think it was part of the era, like of that particular culture of that time?
Yeah, because my sister, though I love her to death, man, she's one of the greatest women ever. But she has vestiges of his thinking and he's fearful of learning. She's fearful of learning new things. My dad was fearful of learning new things.
So she doesn't burn barns down in her spare time.
No, she's a very good person. She's a good person. And she's got great children. So I admire her. I look up to her. But every once in a while, I see, you know, traces of dad's thinking, you know, like, well, why are you thinking like that? You don't have to think like that, you know? But she lives with relatives. And so there's a fear factor of survival. I mean, you know, go along to get along. I mean, why should she think anything else but what everybody else thinks? And I know my relatives are just human beings. I guess now I can use it as an epithet. They're human beings.
Toss it as an expletive if you want to.
An expletive, I'm sorry.
both work.
Both, yeah, okay. So I have a yin and yang thing about my dad.
Did you ever turn down roles just because you were
All the time.
Yeah, like just because this director sucks, I don't like the story.
No, because I have I'm a dyslexic. So that's why I guess I'm artistic. See, those are my two paintings right there. But I can't memorize lines very easily. Because I have a hard time focusing, unless it's visual. Like I can spend hours on one painting, but if you give me a part, I don't have it here.
So that's why improv.
I have one page. I'm doing a part. I'm doing a role for a friend. So it's one page of dialogue. It's just a full page, like a monologue, essay, on one page. So I have to memorize that. That is taking me longer to memorize than either of those two paintings. For some reason, linear words and mathematics is very difficult for me.
Is that why improv was so important to
you? Oh, man, you bet. That's very astute, very astute. Yeah, I'm the coolest at improvising. I just can run.
Yeah, that's an amazing skill.
Oh, it is, but it's miraculous. I have no control over it. So I, in other words, I don't have to think about it. To me, it's grace. Getting out on stage is so peaceful. And I've improvised for 10 years with the committee. I was on stage for 10 years. And as soon as I get out on stage, everything is fine and dandy, you know?
Okay, Larry, so there's a Frenchman and a toaster and a candle. Improv right now. Just kidding.
French with a toaster and a candle.
I'm the candle.
And his apartment's in France. So I don't know where the toaster comes in, Greg. Other than all of the alcohol you've been drinking.
The toaster.
That's part of the improv.
Okay, there, I'm the toaster. Okay.
So my hair looks like today.
Oh yeah. Whoops, there you go.
Well, this has been great. Do you guys have any other questions you want to ask him?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure he's got more important things to continue to listen to.
Because we're going to sequester the jury pretty soon and see who won the case.
It's going to be a hung jury, I think.
Yeah.
Well, we're not actually putting Homo sapiens on trial. We're merely representing Homo sapiens in a certain extent. On trial, we'll be looking for another day.
Oh, I'm putting them on
those
trial
are special,
every minute.
Special episodes are on trial, although
I'm
I don't
done
think
with
we don't really follow our own format very well either. So it's like there's what like this tenuous
Brendan
grip.
Say here? Brendan is trying to interrupt. What do you got to say, Brendan?
I was going to say that while Homo sapiens are not on trial, I think we've come to the conclusion that we need to, I think our client of Homo sapiens needs to be elevated to a different status, and
they got to take care of their shit.
They got to take care of their shit
and not do it on the floor and sleep in it.
And you know,
we can't evolve fast enough. Like dodo birds. Do you know how dodo birds became extinct? Does anybody know?
People ate them, didn't they?
No. No, that's not quite it. That's part of it. No, dodo birds became extinct because they had no enemies on the island. No other animals ate dodo birds on the island of dodo birds. But sailors did, and they were easy to catch because since dodo birds had no enemies,
they
just
have a reason
ate
to run.
And
that
ate
makes sense.
And ate until they couldn't fly anymore and were slow runners. So sailors just ate them until they all disappeared on this one island because the sailors could run faster than the dodo birds, and the dodo birds couldn't evolve fast enough to get themselves to fly. What they would do is they would run. You know, like you see sometimes some seagulls, they run along before they flap like ducks. Well, they would run because they were thinking, yeah, if I get up enough speed, I could flap, but they never could get airborne. So the sailors would catch him ultimately.
If we could just get some cannibals to Florida, I think we could institute a dodo bird policy.
You could evolve.
You're saying they're not there already?
But only eat human beings, not Homo sapiens.
No, just
critical thinkers. Leave critical.
Just the dodo bird type human beings. That's all I'm suggesting.
Right. Right.
They can airdrop them into trailer parks to start with.
Well, you know what?
Now you're delineating people, Brendan.
Okay, Brendan. No, I'm going to start instead of calling, human beings now to me are dodo birds.
Oh, yeah. Homo sapiens, they're the ones going extinct.
Birds. There's two kinds of people. Homo sapiens and dodo birds. Thank you, Brendan.
I agree 100%.
Haven't heard the word dodo used in a long time to describe somebody. It's it was kind of falling out of favor.
But then the
dinosaurs had a good excuse to go extinct, like a also fucking meteorite.
Easter Island, the same thing.
We didn't even have a good excuse. We're just doing it ourselves. Like,
as a matter of fact, Easter Island is a perfect example of what I'm talking about Homo sapiens and human beings. Human beings were on Easter Island, and they became extinct.
Right, because they started eating each other.
They didn't think, they started eating each other, but they didn't think about the future of canoes and houses. They kept on chopping down trees to burn it. And then there was no more trees. And then there was no more food. And then there was no more.
That was like Earth.
It was like an apple in space and fungus. And Easter Island is a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
I keep hearing the word apple in space, and I'm thinking of it as like a rocket, and it's like shooting through space. It's getting the visual of apple in space.
Well,
anyway.
An apple in space, it's an apple, a black apple core in space after about 1,000 years of human beings. How long we've been around? We've been around for,
6,000 years. Read your Bible.
No, 350,000 years.
Yeah, about
350,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then before that, we were kind of erect monkeys. And I think they were cool. I think after erect monkeys, we started to shit the bed, as we say.
I think we were big shitting for our bed britches. The entire time, actually. So maybe we're not evolving anymore. We're actually regressing.
Well, that too.
Devolution.
A couple of people I know.
As
going
soon
back
as
to
I
flippers for fingers.
As soon as I stood up, I knew I had shit the bed. That is going to be my autobiography.
That'll be your anthropological
the title?
Study of mankind.
Yes,
yeah, the anthropological. Yeah, soliloquy.
As we stood
that's
up,
on
we
our.
Shit
that's
the bed.
On our tombstone.
One more thing for our non-existent
tombstone.
Merchandise we'll be selling.
As soon as I stood up, I shit the bed.
With the apple.
Now I don't know if you know this, Larry, but nobody really listens to the show. There's like two people, and whenever we get email from somebody, I read it over the show. So this is our first actual email from somebody who's not related to Greg.
Oh, okay.
So I wanted the guys to hear this because I don't think they've heard it yet. So this is from somebody named Shanty. And he sent it via the website. Our website, everybody, is www.qsblaw.org. Shanty. He says, "What's up, guys? Just got to say I've been listening for a while, and I love the concept you three have going on. I left a review on Apple, so I feel it would be redundant to repeat what I wrote there. If you would ever like to collaborate on something in the future, get a hold of us. Let us know what you think." He sent a link to his own program, which is like Happy Hour Radio or something like that. So,
do you have a concept?
Yelling out to Shanty. Thanks for sending us an email. It goes for anybody else who wants to email us. It will get read during the course of the show. And I want to thank Larry very, very much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks.
It's
an
honor
to
have you.
Cool.
And if you ever want to join us, I don't know why you would, but if you ever want to join us again for a similar conversation, if you've got a particular topic you want to talk about.
Oh, okay. If I get a topic, I'll come on.
Yeah, whatever it happens to be, we would gladly promote you. I truly enjoyed it. I can't speak for Brendan and Greg. I can only assume that they will gladly hand you as well.
I enjoyed it, except for
it was horrible.
No, I enjoyed it, except for Brendan, Greg, and Matt.
Oh, that makes sense. That's typically what turns people off from the show.
Hey, if stand-up comedy gets going again and you want to come to Florida, let me know.
Okay. You got it, man. Because I'm hungry to get on the stage. I love being a stand-up. That was a stand-up social, what did I say? Anthropologist. Stand-up social anthropologist. I don't know. Did that come through in this diatribe we had here?
That yes. You're a social, you're a stand-up social anthropologist?
Social anthropologist. I think totally. That's right,
I think
right?
That's how you should actually put that on your resume when you go out
yeah,
to new gigs.
Yeah, I think
gigs.
So. Okay.
Anyway, but we right, usually cool. say thanks, Maria, when we end, so...
Okay.
Thanks, Maria. This has been the Law Offices of Quibble, Squabble, and Bicker Computer Telecast, where any advice has been designed purely for amusement and deep-sea diving. Please take a candy on your way out, pet the lion tamer, and subscribe to this computer telecast if you know it's good for you. The Law Offices of Quibble, Squabble, and Bicker deny all culpability in today's events and are not to be confused with real law offices that have a secretary and books and stuff. Thank you all. Have a good day.